This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got, a full series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com. So imagine it's August 1st, 2012.
Okay.
You're running a massive trading firm called Knight Capital. At 9:30 a.m., the opening bell rings, and a technician has accidentally left some obsolete code on a single live server.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And over the next 45 minutes, that ghost code just rapidly buys and sells millions of shares of stock it was never supposed to touch. The algorithm just keep firing. By 10:15 a.m., when someone finally figures out how to, pull the plug, the firm has lost $440 million.
Wow.
In under an hour. They're functionally bankrupt. So welcome to Function 4 for the Series 24 exam. Today is all about controlling that exact chaos. We're looking at the rules designed to prevent a multi-million dollar meltdown, how to supervise traders, how to route orders, and basically how to catch bad behavior before it destroys the firm.
Right, and that Knight Capital story is actually the perfect anchor for what we're doing today. Because when you're studying for the Series 24, it's really easy to look at the FANINARA and SEC rules as just this dry list of compliance chores.
Definitely.
But, I mean, every single rule in Function 4 was essentially written in blood. Or, well, written in spectacular financial ruin, right? So our goal today is to build a mental movie. We aren't going to just memorize the rules. We're going to understand the mechanics of why the market forces these guardrails into place.
Exactly. And to make that mental movie stick, we're bringing in a cast of recurring characters. So we'll be using them throughout this entire deep dive to test out these rules in real time. First up, we have Trader Timmy.
Okay, Trader Timmy.
Yeah, Timmy works at a fictional broker-dealer. Let's just call it Reckless Capital.
Okay.
Timmy is enthusiastic. He's highly caffeinated. And he basically views compliance rules as mild suggestions, blocking his path to a massive year-end bonus. He is always looking for the loophole.
Right. And trying to block those loopholes, we have Compliance Carol. She is Reckless Capital's chief compliance officer. She's seen it all. She documents everything. And her primary mission in life is basically to stop Timmy's nonsense before the regulators show up with subpoenas.
Right. And finally, we have customer Carl. Carl is just an everyday retail investor sitting on his couch, scrolling his brokerage app, trying to buy 100 shares of a tech stock without getting front run or trampled by, institutional algorithms.
Right.
So before Timmy can even log into his terminal to trade Carl's money or the firm's capital, Reckless Capital has to establish boundaries.
Right.
And they do this through something called a trader mandate.
Yeah. So think of a mandate as the firm's contractual perimeter for a trader. It's a written authorization that explicitly spells out Timmy's sandbox. It defines the specific products he is allowed to trade, like NMS equities,
Yeah. Sure.
Unhedged options, maybe not.
Okay.
It sets his daily position limits, his maximum allowable losses, the specific counterparties he's allowed to deal with, and even the hours he's permitted to trade. It is highly specific.
So I picture it like an invisible shock collar.
Right.
It defines the edge of the yard. If Timmy wanders past the limit, he gets zapped. But here's the thing about an invisible fence. It only works if it's plugged in and somebody is actually watching the dog.
Exactly.
So here's where the exam tries to get you. If Reckless Capital writes a brilliant, ironclad, 50-page mandate for Timmy and puts it in a binder, leaves it on a shelf, does that count as a supervisory system?
It absolutely does not. The exam loves to test this distinction because documentation is not supervision. To comply with FINRA rules, Compliance Carol has to actively implement and enforce that mandate, meaning reviewing daily exception reports. If Timmy is capped at holding a $5 million overnight position and the system flags that he's holding $7 million, what does Carol do?
Right. So what if she just calls him up, yells at him, tells him to quietly unwind the extra $2 million, and then deletes the email alert? Problem solved, right? The position is fixed.
Oh, that is a massive supervisory failure.
Yeah.
If she just quietly unwinds the trade without documenting the breach and escalating it according to the firm's procedures, she's essentially converted Timmy's one-time rule violation into a documented pattern of the firm failing to supervise. She just bought the liability. A mandate only protects the firm if the firm acts on the breaches.
Makes sense. Okay, so Timmy has his mandate. Now we need to look at the physical architecture of the trading floor, which brings in a major concept for regulation SHO. So Reg SHO is the rule book for short selling, and we need to talk about aggregation units.
Right.
Let me set up a hypothetical. Timmy sits on the proprietary short selling desk. He wants to short 10,000 shares of XYZ stock. But down the hall, completely isolated from Timmy, Reckless Capital has an index arbitrage desk. And that desk happens to be sitting on 50,000 shares of XYZ stock going long. From the perspective of the SEC, is Reckless Capital net long or net short?
Well, if you look at the firm as one giant bucket, they are technically net long 40,000 shares, but Reg SHO recognizes that modern broker-dealers are these massive, complex machines. So it offers firms a tool called aggregation units.
Okay.
And this allows a firm to calculate its net positions at the desk level rather than across the entire firm.
Which is fascinating, right? Because it lets the firm treat different trading desks almost like totally separate mini broker-dealers.
Yeah.
For the purpose of marking trades as long or short.
Yeah.
But they can't just declare this arbitrarily, right? Like, there have to be mechanics behind what qualifies as an independent unit.
Oh, definitely. There are four strict requirements. First, the unit has to have a clearly defined trading objective. You can't just group five random traders together and call it a unit. Second, the positions cannot be commingled. Ownership and P&L must be completely independent. Third, the firm needs a written plan describing the boundaries of the unit. And fourth, there must be physical or functional separation. So Timmy's short desk and the index arbitrage desk cannot share a brain, they cannot share a book, and they cannot share strategies.
Okay, so let's test this.
Sure.
Think about this scenario for a second. Let's say Timmy is having a brutal week on the short desk. He wants to sell some XYZ stock, but he knows that short selling rules require a bunch of extra paperwork and locates.
Right.
He knows the index desk down the hall has a massive long position in XYZ. So Timmy literally unplugs his keyboard, walks down the hall, pulls up a chair at the index desk, and enters his trade from there so he can mark it as a, quote, long sale against their inventory. So if I'm Timmy, that feels like a genius life hack.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm guessing the SEC sees it differently.
Oh, they view that as blatant market manipulation.
Wow.
It's a severe Reg SHO violation. The rule prohibits sham aggregation. Reassigning a trader or moving positions between desks purely to avoid marking a ticket as short, I mean, that defeats the entire purpose of the netting requirement.
Yeah.
If Timmy's aggregation unit is short, his sale is marked short, period. He cannot just borrow the neighbor's inventory for an afternoon to avoid compliance.
Okay, so we've boxed Timmy in with mandates and aggregation units. But let's go back to our Knight Capital disaster.
Right.
Even with rules in place, what physically stops Timmy from leaning his elbow on the zero key, bypassing all human checks, and accidentally buying 1 million shares instead of 1,000?
That brings us to the technological bouncer of the market. The market access rule.
Okay.
When customers or proprietary traders like Timmy need to execute trades at lightning speed, they send those orders to an exchange. But before this rule existed, broker-dealers used to offer something called unfiltered or naked sponsored access to their biggest algorithmic clients.
I always try to visualize this because unfiltered access is basically like connecting a high-pressure fire hose directly to the delicate copper plumbing inside your house and just completely bypassing the pressure regulator valve.
It's not just that the water or the orders are coming in fast. It's that the sheer unfiltered volume will literally blow the pipes apart before anyone can physically reach the shutoff switch.
Mm.
Or tossing a toddler the keys to a Ferrari without a seatbelt.
That is exactly what happened historically, which is why the SEC outright banned naked sponsored access. Under the market access rule, every single order, no matter how fast the client is, must pass through the broker-dealer's own risk controls before it touches the exchange.
And the rule isn't vague about this either. It spells out four mandatory risk controls that Reckless Capital has to build into the plumbing.
Right. So first, we have pre-trade financial controls. These are hard stops that prevent orders from exceeding preset credit or capital limits. If Timmy's mandate caps him at $10 million in exposure, the computer simply will not transmit the order that pushes him to $10 million in one. Second are the pre-trade regulatory controls. The system has to physically check if the order complies with SEC rules. Like if Timmy punches in a short sale, the system checks if he actually has a valid locate for the shares before letting the order leave the building.
Okay.
Third is the erroneous order control, which is the direct fix for the fat finger elbow drop. The system checks price and size parameters. It looks for orders that are wildly off the current market price or orders that are suspiciously duplicative, you know, like an algorithm firing the same 100 share order 10,000 times in a second.
Right, right.
And the fourth is post-trade surveillance. Even after the trade executes, the system has to watch the tape to look for manipulative behavior like spoofing, which we'll dissect a bit later.
Yeah.
Now, here's a critical distinction that tests your understanding of the mechanics.
Okay.
Let's say Timmy enters an order that triggers the erroneous size parameter. The system flashes a bright red warning on a screen that says, "Warning, this order exceeds normal size limits." Click YS to proceed.
Oh, this is the trap flag, right. If the system allows Timmy to just click YES and push it through, Reckless Capital has failed the market access rule.
Exactly. The requirement is that these pre-trade controls must be designed to block or reject non-compliant orders. They cannot merely flag them. They cannot just be speed bumps. They have to be concrete walls.
Right. The bouncer at the club can't just politely ask you not to bring a weapon inside.
Right.
The bouncer has to physically tackle you if you try to walk past them. And because this rule is literally the only thing preventing another Knight Capital event, the regulators demand absolute accountability at the top. The controls have to be reviewed annually.
So I have a question.
Sure.
You're looking at the organizational chart for Reckless Capital. You have the head trader. You have Compliance Carol. You have the chief risk officer.
Oh.
Who is legally required to personally sign the document certifying that these market access controls are effective every single year? Is it Compliance Carol?
Nope.
Right. It's not Carol. It's the CEO. This is a vital point for the exam. The CEO, or the equivalent most senior officer, must personally certify the annual review. They have to swear that the controls work and that any deficiencies were fixed. They cannot delegate that signature to the chief compliance officer.
Which makes perfect sense mechanically.
Yeah.
Because if you want the IT department to get a massive budget to build bulletproof trading infrastructure, you make the CEO personally liable if it fails.
Absolutely.
That is how you get the checks written. Okay, so Timmy's order has survived the technological bouncer. Let's dig into the art of the short sale.
Uh-huh.
Timmy wants to short a stock. We mentioned Regs SHO earlier with the aggregation units, but we really need to look at the mechanics of the trade itself.
Yeah, Regulation SHO is the SEC's master framework for preventing abusive short selling. When you short a stock, you are selling something you don't own. You borrow the shares, sell them into the market today, and hope the price drops so you can buy them back cheaper tomorrow. Return the borrowed shares and pocket the difference. But the entire system collapses if you can't actually find the shares to borrow in the first place.
Which brings us to the locate requirement.
Precisely. Before Reckless Capital can even accept a short sale order from a customer, or enter one for Timmy, they must locate the security. They need reasonable grounds to believe the security can be borrowed and delivered by the settlement date.
And the timing of this locate is a classic exam trap. This is where they try to get you. Because if I'm Timmy and I see a stock tanking, I want to hit the sell button immediately. Can I execute the short sale right now at 10 a.m. and then spend the rest of the afternoon calling around to prime brokers to see if anyone has the shares I can borrow before settlement day?
Absolutely not. The locate must happen before order entry. You have to secure the borrow or have reasonable grounds to believe you can get it before the order ever leaves your desk. You cannot shoot first and locate later.
Now, there is an exception to this, and it's important to understand why it exists. The locate requirement has a carve-out for bona fide market making. If Timmy's desk is registered as a market maker in that specific stock, he doesn't need to do a locate before he shorts it. Why is that?
Well, because market makers are the shock absorbers of the market. Their job is to provide continuous liquidity. If customer Carl wants to buy 100 shares of XYZ right this second, and Timmy is the market maker, Timmy is obligated to sell it to him, even if Timmy doesn't currently own any XYZ in his inventory.
Oh, I see.
Timmy has to short it just to fill the customer's order. If market makers had to pause, pick up the phone, and secure a locate for every single retail buy order that comes through, the stock market would literally grind to a halt.
The operative word there, though, is bona fide market making, right?
Right.
Because if Timmy decides he thinks the company's a fraud, and he puts on his market maker hat just to initiate a massive directional proprietary short position against the company to crash the price, I mean, he loses the exemption. He's no longer providing liquidity. He's placing a bet.
Exactly.
But let's say Timmy does a proper short. He locates it, he shorts it. But when settlement day arrives, the prime broker calls and says, sorry, those shares we thought we had to lend you, they're gone. Timmy cannot deliver the shares to the buyer. This is a fail to deliver.
Fails to deliver are the SEC's worst nightmare because they undermine the trust in the entire clearing system. If you fail to deliver, you are subject to the closeout requirement. The firm must physically go into the open market and purchase or borrow securities of like kind and quantity to close out the fail.
The timelines for this are completely different depending on the type of trade, so we should look at them side by side.
Mm.
If it's a short fail, meaning Timmy shorted the stock, didn't own it, and failed to deliver, he has to close it out by the start of regular trading hours on T+1.
Right.
That is the very next business day after settlement. But if it is a long fail, meaning customer Carl actually owned the physical shares, sold them, but for some administrative reason, the paperwork got lost and he failed to deliver, Reckless Capital has until the start of trading on T+3 to close it out.
Wait, why? The massive disparity. 1 day versus 3 days.
It comes down to systemic risk. A long fail is almost always a clerical error. The shares exist, they're just stuck in administrative limbo. The SEC can wait 3 days for the paperwork to clear. But a short fail.
A short fail means someone sold a phantom share into the market. If left unchecked, abusive naked short selling can artificially dilute a company's stock and drive a legitimate business into bankruptcy. The SEC treats short fails like a virus. They put it on a viciously tight T+1 leash to kill it immediately.
And if a specific stock gets infected with too many of these fails across the entire market, it gets quarantined. It gets placed on the threshold security list. The math you need to recall for a threshold security involves three conditions.
Right.
It has to have aggregate fails to deliver for 5 or more consecutive settlement days. Those fails must total 10,000 or more shares. And D, those fails must represent at least 0.5% of the issuer's total outstanding shares. 5 days, 10,000 shares, 0.5%. If a stock hits that list, the rules on shorting it become incredibly strict.
Yeah, Red SHO isn't just concerned with settlement, though. It also polices intraday pricing behavior when a stock is crashing. That's where we get the alternative uptick rule.
This acts like an automated circuit breaker, specifically for short sellers. So what triggers it?
It triggers if a covered security drops 10% or more from its prior day's closing price.
Okay, so if the stock closed at $100 yesterday, and today at 11 a.m. it drops to $90, boom, the circuit breaker snaps on. What does that actually do to Timmy? Can he still short the stock?
He can, but he is fundamentally restricted in how he does it. Once the rule triggers, any short sale must be priced above the national best bid, or NBB.
So if the current market is $90 on the bid and $90.05 on the offer, and Timmy wants to short, normally he would just hit the bid aggressively. He'd sell at $90 and take the liquidity. But under the alternative uptick rule, he can't do that, right?
Exactly. He is barred from taking liquidity on the bid. He is forced to price his short sale above $90, meaning he has to post an offer maybe at $90.01 and sit there passively. He has to wait for a buyer to willingly cross the spread and take his shares.
It mechanically neuters the short seller. They can no longer aggressively hammer the bid down, penny by penny, to accelerate a panic. They're forced to be passive providers of liquidity. So how long is Timmy stuck in this penalty box? If it triggers at 11 a.m., does it reset at the end of the day?
Oh, the penalty is sticky. It lasts for the remainder of that trading day plus the entire next trading day.
Got it. Okay, let's pivot. Let's say Timmy gets promoted. He's no longer just an aggressive proprietary trader hunting for arbitrage. Reckless Capital makes him the head of a market-making desk. He's now officially registered to make a market in XYZ stock. How does his life change?
Oh, it changes drastically because he now has affirmative obligations to the market. When you register as a market maker, you are publicly declaring, I am a source of continuous liquidity. You can't just trade when the setups look profitable. You are legally required to maintain two-sided continuous quotations during normal business hours from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern.
Right. And two-sided means he has to be willing to play both sides of the fence simultaneously. He must post a bid, which is the price he will buy your stock for, and an offer, the price he will sell his stock to you for. But back in the Wild West days, market makers found a way to cheat this rule using something called stub quotes. Let me explain the mechanics of a stub quote because it's hilarious, but also incredibly dangerous.
Oh, absolutely.
Imagine I'm legally required to have a car for sale at all times. So I take a rusted out 2004 Honda Civic with no doors, and I list it on Craigslist for $12 million. Technically, yes, I am offering a car for sale, but economically, it's a phantom quote. Nobody's ever going to take it. Market makers used to do this. If XYZ was trading at $100, Timmy might post a bid of one penny and an offer of $99,000. He technically fulfilled his two-sided quote obligation, but he took zero risk because the prices were so absurd.
And that exact behavior contributed to the 2010 flash crash. When the market went into free fall, all the real liquidity dried up. Algorithmic sell orders were still executing at the market, and they started hitting those one-penny stub quotes. Blue chip stocks momentarily traded for a single cent because the stub quotes were the only bids led in the book.
Which is terrifying. So Omid Arar killed the stub quote.
Yeah.
By introducing the designated percentage.
Right. Market makers can no longer post quotes in the stratosphere. Their quotes must remain within a designated percentage band surrounding the national best bid and offer, or the NBBO. If the NBBO moves, Timmy's quotes have to move with it to stay within that band. It forces the market maker to maintain economically relevant prices.
Okay, but what if Timmy's trading terminal catches on fire? Or what if he gets food poisoning and has to run to the bathroom? Can he just pull his quotes down?
This requires us to look at the withdrawal rules, because the intent behind the withdrawal dictates the penalty. If there is a legitimate, uncontrollable event like equipment failure, a sudden severe illness, or a legal complication, the firm can apply for an excused absence.
Right.
If Feinerod grants it, Timmy can withdraw his quotes temporarily without a penalty, fix the computer, and come back.
But what if Timmy is just staring at a bloodbath on his screens? The market is insanely volatile, he's bleeding capital on every trade, and he just decides, you know what, I'm out. I don't want to play today.
And he voluntarily withdraws his quotes.
If he does that, the hammer comes down. A voluntary termination of registration in that security carries a mandatory 20 business day penalty.
20 business days. That's effectively a full calendar month.
It is severe on purpose. The market relies on market makers the most during times of extreme volatility. You cannot be a fair weather friend. If you voluntarily abandon your post when the market gets tough, Feinerod will not let you return until the storm is long gone. Now, let's add a massive conflict of interest to Timmy's life. What if Reckless Capital's investment banking division is acting as the lead underwriter for a brand new secondary offering of XYZ stock? The firm is trying to sell 5 million new shares to the public at $50 a share, but Timmy is currently the active market maker for XYZ stock in the secondary market.
Oh, this is a recipe for manipulation, which is governed by Regulation M.
Think about the power Timmy has here. If the firm needs the public to believe $50 is a great deal, Timmy could theoretically use his market-making desk to aggressively bid the stock up in the open market. He could start bidding 51, 52, 53, creating an artificial frenzy. Suddenly, the $50 offering looks like a massive discount.
Right, and to prevent that exact scenario, RegM forces Timmy to become a passive market maker during what's called the restricted period, which is usually the few days right before the offering is priced.
What does passive actually mean in terms of his keyboard?
It means his hands are tied regarding price discovery. He is still allowed to provide liquidity, but he cannot lead the market higher. Mechanically, his bid cannot exceed the highest independent bid. If an independent market maker at another firm bids $50, Timmy can match them and also bid $50.
Got it.
But he absolutely cannot step up and bid $50.01. He cannot be the one pulling the price upward.
And he is also restricted on volume, right? He can't just sit at $50 and absorb infinite selling pressure to artificially prop the floor up.
Correct. A passive market maker is subject to a daily net purchase limit. It is capped at the greater of 30% of the stock's average daily trading volume, the ADTV, or 200 shares. The moment Timmy's net purchases hit that mathematical limit, his passive market making day is over. He must withdraw his quotes for the rest of the day.
While we are looking at market maker conflicts, we absolutely have to hammer home one of the brightest bright line rules on the Series 24. We're talking about payments for market making. Let's say the CEO of a small cap company wants more liquidity in their stock. They call up Reckless Capital, say, hey, if Timmy agrees to maintain quotes in our stock every day, we'll pay the firm a $10,000 monthly retainer. We just want to ensure our shareholders have liquidity. Can Reckless Capital accept that deal?
Absolutely. Unequivocally, no. An issuer can never pay a broker-dealer to make a market in its stock.
Wow.
The prohibition is absolute. No cash retainers, no stock options, no warrants, no covering Timmy's desk fees, no free office space, nothing.
Why so strict?
Because the market runs on the assumption that quoted liquidity is real. It assumes that if Timmy is quoting a stock, he's doing it because there is genuine supply and demand from investors. If issuers could pay for quotes, it creates rented liquidity.
Oh, I see.
The public would see tight spreads and high volume, assuming the stock is healthy, without realizing it's an illusion funded by the company's treasury. It's inherently deceptive.
The only exceptions you'll see on the exam are bona fide investment banking fees, like underwriting the actual IPO, and reimbursements for pure regulatory fees, like SEC or a fine and R registration cost for the stock. But paying for the actual quoting activity, completely radioactive.
Okay, let's step away from Timmy's desk for a minute and focus on customer Carl.
Okay.
Carl is sitting on his couch. He opens his app and hits buy 100 shares of XYZ at $50 limit. He hits submit. Where does that order actually go? Reckless Capital has connections to the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, three different dark pools, and a half dozen wholesale market makers. How do they decide who gets Carl's order? This brings us to the intersection of two huge rules, a finer or best execution and regulation NMS. Let's start with best execution. Best execution is the overarching fiduciary duty. FINRA rules dictate that a firm must use reasonable diligence to ascertain the best market for a security and execute the customer's order at a price as favorable as possible under current market conditions.
Reasonable diligence sounds great in a textbook, but mechanically, Reckless Capital might process 5 million retail orders a day. They cannot have a human being manually checking six different venues for every single 10-share order. Mm-hmm. So how do they prove they are fulfilling this fiduciary duty?
Well, if a firm is using automated routing and not conducting an order-by-order review, they are required to perform a regular and rigorous review of their execution quality.
Let's break down the mechanics of that review. First, frequency. It must happen at least quarterly. Second, granularity. This is where firms fail. You cannot just look at a giant firm-wide spreadsheet and say, overall, we got good prices. The review must be broken down by security and by order type.
And why is that granularity important? Because venues perform differently. A specific dark pool might offer incredible price improvement for small cap energy stocks when using limit orders, but that exact same dark pool might offer terrible execution speed for large cap tech market orders.
Right.
Reckless Capital has to review the data to ensure their algorithms are routing Carl's specific type of order to the venue historically best suited for it.
Okay, here's a hypothetical for you. What if Reckless Capital's parent company owns a separate, smaller routing broker-dealer? Can Reckless Capital automatically route Carl's order through their affiliate sister company, let the affiliate take a one-penny markup as a profit, and then send it to the exchange?
That practice is called interpositioning, inserting a middleman into a transaction. And it is strictly illegal unless the firm can definitively prove that it resulted in a better execution for the customer.
Right. You cannot add a toll booth to the highway just to extract a fee. If routing it through the affiliate somehow got Carl access to a hidden liquidity pool that saved him 5 cents a share, well then, taking a one-penny toll is justifiable because Carl still netted a 4-cent benefit.
Exactly.
But if the affiliate just passes it to NASDAQ, exactly like Reckless Capital could have done directly, that is illegal interpositioning. Now, best execution is the conceptual fiduciary duty, but regulation NMS is the hard mechanical plumbing of the national market system. RegMS relies on a massive amount of data transparency to keep everyone honest. And this requires us to look at two specific, highly testable reports, Rule 605 and Rule 606. Let's deduce why these are different. First, we have the execution quality report, Rule 605. Second, we have the order routing report, Rule 606. Who files what and how often?
The execution quality report is filed by the market center, the venue itself, the New York Stock Exchange, the dark pool, the wholesale market maker. They must file this report monthly. It contains statistical data on how well they actually executed the orders they received. Did they improve the price? How fast was the turnaround?
And the order routing report.
That is filed by the broker-dealer, Timmy's firm, Reckless Capital. It is filed quarterly. This report does not judge the quality of the trades. Instead, it discloses where the firm chose to send its customer non-directed orders.
And this is where the juiciest piece of data lives. Payment for order flow or PFOF.
Exactly. When Reckless Capital routes Carl's order to a specific wholesale market maker, that wholesaler often pays Reckless Capital a fraction of a penny per share for the privilege of executing that order. That is payment for order flow.
This is literally how commission-free trading apps make their money. And the SEC says, fine, you can do that, but you have to tell the public exactly who was paying you and how much. That disclosure lives in the quarterly Rule 606 routing report. So to lock it in, market centers file execution reports monthly, broker-dealers file routing reports quarterly. Now, RegNMS also features a mechanical enforcer called the Order Protection Rule, often referred to as the Trade-Through Rule. Let's say the national best bid and offer, the NBBO for XYZ, is $50 bid, $50.05 offer.
Okay.
Customer Carl places a market order to buy. Reckless Capital routes it to a smaller regional exchange where the best offer is sitting at $50.10, and it executes at $50.10.
That is a trade through. The firm executed a trade at a worse price, $50.10, than what was visibly available on another exchange, $50.05. The order protection rule strictly prohibits this. The firm's routing systems must be programmed to capture the absolute best price available in the national system.
But wait, the exam loves to test the boundaries of this rule. This is where they try to get you. The order protection rule does not protect every quote in the market, right?
Correct. It only protects automated top-of-book quotes.
Write that down.
Top-of-book means the absolute best price on that specific exchange. If NASDAQ has offers stacked at 50.05, 50.06, and 50.07, only the 50.05 is protected by the rule. The others are depth of book, and they have no trade-through protection.
Oh, wow.
And automated means the quote can be executed against instantaneously by a computer. If a quote is manual, meaning it requires a human specialist on a trading floor to physically confirm the trade, the computers treat that quote like a ghost. You can trade right through a manual quote without violating the rule, because in the milliseconds it takes to route an order, a manual quote is too slow to rely on.
The last major piece of Reg NMS plumbing is the subpenny rule. This dictates the minimum pricing increments, or tick sizes, for stocks. And the math here is a hard threshold. If a stock is priced at $1 or more, the minimum increment is 1 penny. If a stock is priced below $1, the minimum increment is 0.0001, 1/100th of a cent. Why does this rule exist? Imagine Carl places a limit order to buy 1,000 shares of XYZ at exactly $10. His order is sitting on the book, providing liquidity. Suddenly, a high-frequency trading algorithm decides it wants those shares. Without the subpenny rule, the algorithm could bid $10 and 1/100th of a cent. By improving the price by a microscopically meaningless fraction of a cent, the algorithm jumps ahead of Carl in line, stealing his priority.
Right, and the subpenny rule forces anyone who wants to jump the line to step up by at least a full penny. It protects the integrity of retail limit orders.
So let's test this logic. Let's say a stock is trading at exactly $1, $1 even. What is the minimum tick size I can use to improve the bid? Well, it's 1 penny, right?
Yes. The regulatory threshold is $1 or more. The moment it touches $1, you are locked into penny increments.
Okay. Take a breath. Stretch your legs. Shake off the technical rules. Because suddenly the market is crashing. News just broke, chaos erupts on the floor, alarms are blaring on Timmy's terminal. We need to talk about pattern interrupts. What happens when normal market mechanics fail and we have to pull the emergency brakes?
The market has two different types of emergency brakes, one for individual stocks and one for the entire market. Let's start with the individual stocks. This is governed by LULD, which stands for Limit Up, Limit Down.
LULD is the ultimate anti-volatility mechanic. Imagine every single stock has an invisible band surrounding its current average price. As the price moves throughout the day, the band moves with it.
The size of that band depends on the stock. For tier one stocks, think S&P 500 companies and major ETFs, the band is typically 5% above and 5% below the reference price. The core rule of LULD is that trades cannot execute outside this band.
So if a news headline drops and XYZ stock instantly plummets 6%, hitting the bottom of the band, what happens mechanically? Does the stock halt immediately?
No, it doesn't halt instantly. The market enters a limit state. Bids and offers can exist outside the band, but no trades can happen there. The math here is crucial for the exam. If the market is locked at the band limit and the stock is unable to trade back inside the band for 15 seconds, then it triggers a 5-minute trading pause.
So it's 15 seconds of sustained pressure against the limit, which triggers a 5-minute timeout. Mm. It gives humans a chance to figure out if the drop is real news or if an algorithm just went rogue. Now, here's the twist. Those tier one bands are normally 5%. But during the last 25 minutes of the trading day, from 3:35 p.m. to 4 p.m., the bands automatically double to 10%.
Why? Because the market naturally experiences a massive surge in volume and volatility as institutional funds rebalance their portfolios into the closing bell. If the band stayed at 5%, you would have stocks constantly pausing right before the close, which would ruin the closing auction. Widening the bands gives the market room to breathe. And notably, there is no corresponding widening at the market open, only the close.
That's individual stocks. But what if it's systemic? What if the entire S&P 500 index starts cratering? That triggers the market-wide circuit breakers, or MWCB. First, an important mechanical detail. The threshold for a market-wide drop is calculated against the S&P 500's prior day's closing price. It is not based on where the market opened this morning.
There are three distinct levels you need to memorize. Level 1 triggers at a 7% drop. Level 2 triggers at a 13% drop. Level 3 triggers at a 20% drop.
If the market hits level 1, the 7%, or level 2, 13%, what is the penalty?
Trading across all U.S. equities and options halts for exactly 15 minutes.
Why 15 minutes? Why not an hour?
15 minutes is precisely enough time for clearing firms to calculate margin calls, for risk managers to pull their algorithmic plugs, and for human beings to assess the panic without freezing global capital for too long.
But here's a massive exam trap regarding time of day. It is the 3:25 p.m. Eastern rule. If the S&P 500 drops 7% at 3:15 p.m., the market halts for 15 minutes. But if the S&P 500 drops 7% at 3:26 p.m., the market does not halt. It keeps trading. Why?
It goes back to the closing auction. The 4 p.m. closing print is the single most important liquidity event of the day. Trillions of dollars in mutual funds and index funds price their assets based on that final print.
Mm.
If you initiate a 15-minute halt at 3:45 p.m., you completely destroy the mechanics of the closing auction. So after 3:25 p.m., regulators decide it's better to just let the level 1 and 2 chaos run its course into the bell rather than risk a broken close.
However, if the market drops 20% and hits a level 3 breaker,
at a 20% drop, the closing auction no longer matters. The panic is systemic. If a level 3 triggers at any time of day, even at 3:55 p.m., trading halts for the remainder of the entire day. Game over.
And during any of these halts, single stock or market-wide, what is Timmy allowed to do? Can he update his quotes? Can he publish an indication of interest to line up a trade for when the market reopens?
The halt trading prohibition is absolute. No quotes, no IOIs, no trades, period. The market is effectively frozen in amber until the primary listing exchange reopens it.
Okay, let's look at the fallout. The market crashed. Reckless capital took a beating. Timmy's proprietary book is deeply in the red, and he's desperate to make his money back before his quarterly performance review. This is where Timmy goes rogue. He starts breaking the conduct rules, entering the world of prohibited trading.
Right. And the first thing desperate traders try is manipulation. Timmy starts spoofing and layering. Spoofing is when Timmy enters massive buy orders for a stock just below the current market price. He has absolutely no intention of actually buying the stock. He is trying to create the false illusion of massive institutional demand. When algorithms see that fake demand, they bid the price up. Timmy then sells his real position at the artificially inflated price and instantaneously cancels all his fake buy orders before they can execute.
Layering is the same concept, but instead of one massive order, he places dozens of fake orders at different price increments to build a fake wall of demand. Both of these violate a core tenet of securities law. All published transactions and quotes must be bona fide. If your underlying intent is to cancel the order before execution, it is not bona fide, it is fraud.
When spoofing isn't fast enough, Timmy might turn to trading ahead. This is a massive testing area, and you need to understand the differences between the three distinct types of trading ahead.
Let's puzzle through them. First is the Manning Rule.
The Manning Rule prohibits a firm from trading ahead of an unfilled customer order. Let's say customer Carl enters a limit order to buy 1,000 shares of XYZ at $50. Reckless Capital accepts the order. If Timmy looks at Carl's order and decides, hey, $50 is a great price, I'll buy 1,000 shares for the firm's proprietary account at $50, he cannot do that until Carl's order is completely filled.
It's about price priority. The customer eats first. If the firm trades for itself at a price that would have satisfied the customer's order, they must immediately fill the customer at that price or better. There are some exceptions. Like if an institutional client signs a negative consent letter, basically saying they don't mind if the firm trades alongside them, but for retail customers like Carl, the protection is ironclad. Next is front running. How is this different from Manning?
Front running specifically deals with trading ahead of a block transaction, which is typically defined as 10,000 shares or more. Let's say Timmy's desk receives a massive market-moving order from a mutual fund to buy 1 million shares of XYZ. Timmy knows that when this order hits the tape, the stock price is going to spike. So, before he executes the mutual funds order, Timmy quickly buys a few thousand shares for his own account.
He is using his confidential knowledge of the block trade to guarantee a profit. But here is the detail that catches people. The front-running rule doesn't just cover the stock itself. If Timmy knows the block of stock is coming, he can't go buy XYZ call options either. He can't buy single stock futures on XYZ. The rule covers the security, related options, and related derivatives. You cannot just pivot to a different instrument to exploit the inside information.
And the third variation is trading ahead of research. A firm cannot adjust its inventory based on advanced knowledge of the content or the timing of a research report. If Timmy hears through the grapevine that Reckless Capital's star analyst is going to upgrade XYZ to a strong buy tomorrow morning, Timmy cannot start loading up the firm's inventory today to dump it onto the retail frenzy tomorrow.
Right. The information barrier between the trading desk and the research department has to be impenetrable. Let's shift to something purely mechanical. Order adjustments, governed by the BS rule. Let's test your logic here. Customer Carl has a sell limit order resting on the book to sell XYZ at $55. XYZ announces a $1 cash dividend. Tomorrow is the ex-dividend date, meaning the stock exchange will automatically reduce the opening price of XYZ by $1 to account for the cash leaving the company. Does Carl's resting sell limit order also automatically adjust down by $1? Well, the answer is no. It stays exactly where it is. Why is that?
Because of the BLESS rule. It stands for buy limit, sell stop. Only orders that are placed below the current market price automatically adjust downward for cash dividends.
Think about the mechanics. A buy limit is placed below the market. A sell stop is placed below the market. If the exchange artificially drops the stock price by a dollar on the ex-dividend date, a sell stop might accidentally get triggered by the mathematical adjustment, not by actual market selling. To prevent that accidental trigger, the exchange drops the order down by the exact same amount.
But a sell limit is placed above the market. Dropping the stock price moves the market further away from the order, so there is no risk of an accidental execution. Therefore, orders above the market do not adjust.
Now, what if Carl wants his buy limit order to stay exactly where it is, regardless of the dividend? He can mark the order DNR, which means do not reduce. The firm will leave it alone during a cash dividend. Okay, let's bring it all together. Timmy is spoofing the book. He's front-running block orders, and eventually the post-trade surveillance systems trigger. Compliance Carol's dashboard lights up with exception reports. What is her legal responsibility in this moment? What is the escalation pathway?
FNRA requires a three-step supervisory response. Recognize, investigate, escalate. First, she must recognize the red flags. You cannot claim ignorance. If the automated surveillance system flags a trade, ignoring it is a supervisory failure. Second, she investigates. She has to pull the trade tickets, review the internal chat logs, and listen to Timmy's recorded phone calls to determine if there is a legitimate explanation. Third, if she suspects wrongdoing, she must escalate. Depending on the severity, she might bring it to the firm's legal counsel, senior management, or even file a suspicious activity report with the government.
Let me highlight a massive career-ending trap for compliance officers here. Let's say Carol investigates, realizes Timmy is violating the Manning rule, and she walks over to his desk. She says, "Timmy, I saw what you did. Cut it out. If I see it again, you're fired." And then she walks away without formally documenting it or escalating it up the chain.
In that scenario, Carol has committed a separate individual supervisory failure. If regulators find out, Reckless Capital gets fined for the Manning violation, but Carol can be individually sanctioned, suspended, or barred for failing to follow the escalation procedures. You cannot just handle it off the books.
Furthermore, if the discovery involves active manipulation, like spoofing or front running, Carol must immediately take two mechanical actions. One, she must freeze trading in the affected accounts. You cannot allow a suspected manipulator to continue operating the machinery while you conduct a multi-week investigation. Two, she must preserve records. She has to implement a litigation hold immediately, lock down the emails, secure the physical order tickets, and archive the risk snapshots. If she lets him keep trading or lets the server auto-delete his emails after 30 days, the firm's legal exposure grows exponentially.
If you look at this entire deep dive holistically, this is why the initial trader mandates, the aggregation units, and the market access rule exist. They are the proactive preventive walls. Escalation is the reactive failsafe. Together, they form the comprehensive supervisory system FINRA expects you to understand.
Exactly. Okay, let's bring this deep dive home. It's time for the rapid fire recap. High energy. I want to lock in the most testable numbers and takeaways from function 4.
Number 1, the locate requirement. You must secure a documented locate before order entry, never before settlement. The exception is bona fide market making.
Number 2, closeouts. Short fails are toxic. Close them out by the start of trading on T+1. Long fails have until T+3.
Number 3, the market access rule. The CEO, nobody else, must certify it annually. The pre-trade controls must physically block or reject non-compliant orders, not just flag them with a warning.
Number 4, market maker withdrawals. If you voluntarily pull your quotes because you don't like the market conditions, you are hit with a massive 20 business day penalty before you can re-register.
Number 5, Reg NMS reports. Rule 605 execution reports are filed monthly by the market centers. Rule 606 routing reports are filed quarterly by the broker dealers, detailing payment for order flow.
Number 6. Market-wide circuit breakers. The thresholds are drops of 7%, 13%, and 20% from the prior day's close. And remember the 3:25 p.m. rule. No level 1 or 2 halts in the final 35 minutes of the trading day to protect the closing auction.
Number 7. Order adjustments. BISS. Buy limits and sell stops, which sit below the market, automatically adjust down for cash dividends unless explicitly marked do not reduce.
That covers the incredibly dense core of Function 4. But before we log off, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Something that isn't explicitly in the textbook yet, but it builds right on top of the rules we just discussed. Think about the post-trade surveillance rules and how we police things like spoofing. The entire legal definition of spoofing is based on human intent. It relies on proving that Trader Timmy entered an order he never actually intended to fill, but we are entering an era where AI and machine learning algorithms are completely taking over trading desks. They operate as black boxes, finding mathematical efficiencies humans can't even see. So how will SEC regulators define intent when the machine is making a billion micro-decisions a second? Who goes to jail when a neural network, left completely to its own devices, independently deduces that spoofing the order book is the mathematically optimal way to maximize its P&L? Does the CEO go to jail because they signed the market access certification? Does the programmer go to jail? Keep that in mind as you study these rules. You are studying the framework of the past, preparing to regulate the machines of the future. The market is evolving faster than the rule book.
A terrifying and fascinating thought to end on. If you understand the underlying mechanics, you'll be ready for whatever the exam throws at you.
Best of luck on the Series 24, everyone. Keep studying and keep diving deep.